Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's my pleasure to welcome you here to the Goodman Cancer Center Public Forum Seminar Series. This season, the focus is on cancer, a disease of a thousand faces. This is our third session in the series. We've had one focused on breast cancer, one focused on lymphoma and leukemias, and tonight we're going to be focusing on cancers of the gastrointestinal tract. My name is Peter Siegel. I'm a researcher here at the Goodman Cancer Center. My laboratory is next door in the Cancer Pavilion. I'm also the Associate Director of the Cancer Center, and along with Morag Park, who's our newly minted Director of the Cancer Center, we'd like to welcome you. The purpose of the public forums are really to showcase how basic science informs potential therapeutic strategies and how those therapeutic strategies are used to manage the disease that we're focusing on.
Thank you very much, Peter. I'll take back the thing. These evenings are for you. The goal here is to provide an informal environment where you can ask questions. You can ask the stupid questions that you don't want to ask anybody else. We will have a mechanism to go around later on in the evening where you can write down your questions and we can ask them privately or you can ask them publicly. I think it's very exciting to see so many of you here at the forum. It clearly highlights how important these are for the public and for you. And we're here to listen to your questions. We're here to respond to what you would like to see. If there are particular areas that you would like discussed in future forums, please let us know. Follow up with us, and we'll try and fulfill whatever you would like to follow through with. This evening should be a very exciting evening. We've got some of the best and the brightest at McGill, who will present to you particularly focused on gastric cancer. And although the Goodman Cancer Research Center hosts these, we're really highlighting the talent that's available throughout the Montreal community. So we're really grateful to everybody who participates, and mostly to you, the public, who come to join us in these events. So thanks very much.
Thank you, Morag. So as Morag was mentioning, we'll have a series of four speakers, and it really bridges the range from clinician scientists to surgical oncologists to basic researchers to the patient experience. So you'll get a flavor of that throughout the spread of the talks tonight. Before I continue, I would like to just mention special thanks to Frank Pittman, who's a representative from the Colorectal Cancer Association of Canada, and Betty Esperanza, who's the regional director for the Canadian Liver Foundation. So both of these organizations have tables just outside of the theater door, and you can stop by for additional information if you're interested. And we thank them both for being here to share that with you. So you should have been given sheets of paper and writing utensils as you came in. The way we'll structure the evening is that we'll have each one of our speakers come up. They'll deliver their talks, and at the end we'll have them all come up and they'll sit at the table and we'll collect those questions from you and we'll answer those in the question and answer period at the end of the evening. So as you're listening to the talks, please write down those questions that you have and a volunteer will collect them from you and we'll make sure to ask those at the end of the talk. So it gives me great pleasure to introduce our first speaker, Dr. Lorenzo Ferri. He's a director of thoracic surgery. He's the director of upper GI cancer at the MUHC. He holds the David S. Mulder Chair of Surgery at the MUHC. And he's also an associate member of the Goodman Cancer Research Center. He's going to talk to you about gastroesophageal cancers, a light at the end of the scope.
Thank you. It's an absolute honor to be here. Thank you very much, Peter and Morag. I think the last time I was in this room was a bit over 24 years ago as a medical student. I sat in the back there. And not to say that I wasn't, interested, just I got a good view of the entire scene. I am going to be talking a very clinical topic. I am a scientist as well. However, I felt that it's important to provide sort of a forum of discussion for some of the new things that we're offering patients, these incredible developments that have happened over the past 5 to 7 years in the treatment of esophageal and gastric cancer. Now, unfortunately, esophageal and upper gastric cancer is rising. Indeed, over the past 30 to 35 years, the tumors of the stomach and the proximal stomach and the esophagus have increased in incidence more than any other cancer in North America. Eightfold increase over the past 30 years. This is faster, higher than anything else that we've seen. There are some slight increases. You can see in prostate, probably from increased diagnosis, and melanoma from the ozone effect. But the other cancers tend to be relatively stable over this period of time. However, stomach, upper stomach, and esophageal cancer is essentially an epidemic for this. Now, why is gastroesophageal cancer rising so much? Traditionally, this is sort of a very McGill-centric, you can see our two very Montreal-based institutions. We have changed ways of funding now. We've looked for different sources of increasing funds for the hospital and for the university. But nonetheless, stomach and esophagus cancer in the past was due primarily to smoking and alcohol. However, this increase is not due to that. This increase is really due to a relative epidemic that we've had over the past 30 years of heartburn, of gastroesophageal reflux disease. And this, in turn, is due to a relative epidemic or an absolute epidemic of obesity. We don't need to tell this audience that if you go down south or even a bit west, you'll see a massive amount of obesity. In some states in the United States, it approaches 40 to 50% of the population is obese. This increases abdominal pressures, increases reflux, and the reflux itself is a risk factor for cancer. How is that? Well, chronic acid reflux, chronic acid heartburn, daily heartburn can cause damage to the esophagus. You can see some redness right here. There's a very inflamed esophagus. And if that goes on for a long period of time, the esophagus likes to think it's smart. So what it does, it changes the lining of the esophagus in order so it doesn't get burned, doesn't feel like it's burned. So what it does, how much you can see right here, this is a normal esophageal lining. And this right here is what we call Barrett's esophagus. And it looks exactly like the stomach lining. So what the esophagus does, it changes the cell type so it no longer gets burnt. So because the stomach is used to acid. So the problem is, when that happens, when Barrett's esophagus, when that change happens, cells can continue to change. Indeed, although severe acid reflux occurs around 20-25% of the population, and Barrett's esophagus occurs around 1-2% of the population. It's a normal adaptive response. When those cells start to change, they can continue to change. And indeed, we know that up to 1 in 1,000 patients with Barrett's will develop a cancer every year. So that means if someone has it for 10 years, they have a 1 in 100 chance of developing a cancer. Now, fortunately, like all malignancies, the majority of esophageal cancer cases are found at later stages. And this is a little bit older, from 2008, but I use it to highlight a point. And esophageal cancer and stomach cancer, this is stomach is here, and esophagus is here. These are 5-year survival rates. As early as only 10 years ago, these types of cancers, stomach esophagus cancer, is quite severe. And the likelihood of us being able to cure them was only 25 to 30% after surgery. However, there have been incredible, over the past 7 to 10 years, there have been incredible developments in surgical technique, in chemotherapy treatment, as well as radiation therapy treatment, that were able to make incredible improvements in this overall survival. So even in people with more advanced diseases, we have improved this remarkably. This is the only survival curve I think I'll present. I apologize. This is our own data. This comes from McGill. This comes from patients treated at the Montreal General and the Jewish General Hospital. We were able to increase that overall survival significantly by twofold to threefold to what it was beforehand. We still have a long way to go. This is just for people who have more advanced diseases. That just shows that we are making remarkable improvements in people who have more advanced tumors. However, like all malignancies, it is best to treat this gastric and esophageal cancer early. The earlier the diagnosis it is, if we have, compared to the tumor we had before, if we have a small tumor like this, if we're able to find it earlier, we can treat it earlier, and with more less invasive types of treatment, so it's not quite as toxic to the body. So it's really important to try to identify those patients who are at risk of developing malignancy. So part of that is really recognizing that if we know that the main risk factor over the past 20 years is really heartburn and obesity, you can look for patients who are at risk. And so it's been well recognized that people have long-standing heartburn, daily heartburn, and that's quite severe. Those patients should be considered for a endoscopy. This is basically a scope through the mouth, allows us to look at the esophagus directly and see if that Barrett's esophagus exists or if there's any other changes in the esophagus. In addition, we have to be really cognizant of certain symptoms that are alarm symptoms that prompt an urgent gastroscopy. And those are things such as difficulty swallowing, or in medical terms, we call that dysphagia, and weight loss. So those are things that bypass everything. Those patients need to be seen immediately. Now, once we have identified people who should be considered for an endoscopy or a gastroscopy to look for these things, there have been remarkable advances in the past 7 years, primarily coming out of Japan. This is where I learned most of these techniques, where they were able to, not only can we visualize them, but we can see them with specialized lighting. In fact, we have a lot of these advances in endoscopic imaging that help identify these tumors. This, for example, this is just a patient who has a smoker, has some mild pain in his chest, but no real symptoms. He undergoes an endoscopy, and it's hard to see anything. Maybe you can see something something right in this area here. However, if you perform a special blue-green image through the gastroscope, again, this is developed primarily out of Japan, you can start to see something a little bit more prominent in the exact same area. And furthermore, if you spray iodine on this, again, this is a new technique, you basically have to be relatively blind in order to see that. It really comes out at you, and that's where the tumor is. And if you just relied on the standard endoscopy that most of us use in North America, we would have missed this tumor. And if we would have missed it, we would have only found it later on, would cause symptoms and made it more harder to treat. Because we can treat these at this stage very, very simply. Well, complexly, but less invasively. So as I've discussed, we know that patients, that Barrett's esophagus can progress to cancer. And the initial instigation of that is this chronic heartburn and reflux. And we know this happens around 25% of people. So it's important to treat that at this stage in order to try to prevent this progression. Barrett's esophagus, we can identify those patients who do have Barrett's esophagus. Because it's so common, and it's actually a normal adaptation of the body to acid, it's a protective mechanism, we don't necessarily need to treat at that time point, but we need to keep an eye on it. And so we recommend that people who identify with Barrett's esophagus undergo routine gastroscopies to look at that. But when we need to intervene, I'd rather not wait until someone has a tumor this far advanced. It would be really nice to see if we can treat them before, in the intermediate steps, when they have this dysplasia, when these cells are starting to turn cancerous. So that's really our targets for our treatment right now, see if we can find some way to target the treatment in this area, because it allows us to treat just with endoscopically and not require invasive surgery, chemotherapy, and radiation therapy. So traditionally, the management of patients who had that high-grade dysplasia of those cells was esophagectomy. We'd take out the esophagus and replace it with a piece of stomach. However, over the past 5 years, even 10 years, primarily coming out of Japan, as I said, there have been a series of technologically advanced endoscopic therapies. So this truly is light at the end of the scope. We have treatments where we can either burn the esophagus or we can remove it through the mouth. So the first of these is particularly adapted to people who have those slight changes, what we call that high-grade dysplasia, when those cancer cells or those cells start to become cancerous, but not actually cancerous yet. So this is an example of that. This is a gentleman who's had has this long Barrett's. He said it's a little slight change of the esophagus. And we can apply a balloon-based energy device through the mouth into the esophagus and burn this esophagus before it has a chance to develop into a tumor. Indeed, here you can see exactly what we're talking about. This is the esophagus, and this catheter is passed through the gastroscope. It is deployed, and the energy is given. And then you can see the lining of the esophagus is burned. It doesn't burn it very far. It just burns it so it gets rid of those abnormal cells. And we clear that off, and you can see this is where we did not burn. This is where we burned. It gets rid of all those cancer cells. And that has been shown to remove or reduce the likelihood of this type of lining to develop into malignancy, into a cancer. Our example is this gentleman. This is someone who's undergone 3 months later after he got that treatment. You can see there's a little bit left over here. And we can just touch up that with another bit of radiofrequency ablation. Now, this is an advanced technology. It's very expensive. We are the only hospital in Quebec who has this technology presently, and one of probably only two or three east of the extremely wealthy province of Alberta. So we do see a lot of people from other provinces and clearly across Quebec. But it has made a big difference because otherwise, I mean, how we treat these people is to remove the entire esophagus, which is quite quite an aggressive operation. In addition, you can see if we have a little nodule, like in this situation, we can do what's called endoscopic resection. We don't have to go in and take out that esophagus to know what we're dealing with. We actually can go in and just take that biopsy, take a large biopsy of that in order to give us a better idea of what we're dealing with so we know how to treat it better. This is an example of an endoscopic resection. Again, it's all through the mouth where the people are awake. They're as if they're going to a regular gastroscope. It takes a little bit longer, but we're able to do all these techniques purely through the mouth with no incisions. So here you can see the small lesion. We identify it. We raise it on a little polyp, and then we remove it. Now, traditionally, again, if we go back when we did this and we found, after doing a biopsy, removing that deep biopsy, we were able to look at it, and if we saw a tumor at that time point, we again would recommend that this patient would undergo an operation, such as an esophagectomy. Now, we know that taking out the esophagus and replacing it with the stomach is a very effective treatment for cancers both early and more advanced. However, it is a big operation. And it is—it's associated with a lot of recovery and not an insignificant number of complications. We know that laparoscopy—if we do it through small incisions—we can reduce some of these complications. However, it still is, even laparoscopically, it's still a big operation. So, if we do less invasively, what about doing no surgery whatsoever if we have a cancer? We talked about being able to treat early precancerous lesions to the mouth. What about if we're able to treat early cancers, actually confirm cancers through the mouth and not make any incisions? That brings us to the concept of endoscopic resection or endoscopic submucosal dissection. This is a technique. We're the only hospital in Canada performing this. We're maybe one of three in North America who perform this operation, where we're able to take out and we're able to scrape off the cancer. This is the esophagus. This is the tumor. And you can see we're able to scrape off that cancer and remove it completely out of the esophagus with the person still awake without any incisions. It takes a little bit longer. It takes around an hour and a half. So the sedation has to be quite good because it is a long procedure. If anyone's undergone a gastroscopy, you recognize that 5 minutes seems like a long time. Well, an hour and a half can seem like a very long time. So we have to. It does require a lot of sedation. Now, in order to justify this procedure, doing this procedure to make sure that we're curing this cancer, we have to fulfill two main criteria. The first, there has to be basically a very, very low risk of lymph node spreading. So we have to know for certain that when we take out that tumor, the chance of having lymph node spread outside of the area that we remove is very low. What we don't want to do is take out the tumor and leave tumor behind in the lymph nodes. So we have to know how to predict the likelihood of that happening. Excuse me. And also, we have to be able to remove it in one piece. And that's where endoscopic submucosal dissection helps us. It lets us move the entire tumor in one piece. So regarding the first criterion, whether or not we can predict the likelihood of developing of that patient having a lymph node that's positive, this data did not exist. So we worked with some of our colleagues across Canada, in the States, and also in Europe. We pooled all our data, and we were able to come up with a very strict criteria based on endoscopic features, So what does the tumor look like? How large it is it? How deep is the tumor? As well as what the tumor looks like on the microscope. So the pathological features, such as something called lymphovascular invasion, or the grade of the tumor. Based on these factors, we can predict very accurately the likelihood of someone's tumor that we removed and them having lymph nodes. And if there are lymph nodes, if that patient has a high risk of lymph node metastasis, then we would have to resort to an operation, a formal operation where we actually remove it. But if it's low, this is now considered curable. This is an example of a patient we treated recently. You can see has, again, a Barrett's esophagus, and there's a tumor right here. It's an early tumor. And we mark out the area of the tumor and remove it with this endoscopic submucosal dissection. At the end of it, you can truly see how we've left the native esophagus here, and we basically stripped off this whole area. This is a normal esophagus here. This is a whole area that we've removed. And now the pathologist can look at it and give us an answer of how likelihood that person has of having lymph node metastasis. And indeed, the final pathology, this is a whole bunch of numbers. You need to really concentrate on them. But what it ends up meaning is that based on that information, I can go back to our data and say that the likelihood of this having a lymph node metastasis or spread to those lymph nodes is less than 1%. Which means we can now consider this a cured esophageal cancer, and it requires no other treatment, no other surgery. So this is done all through the mouth. So here you can see the same gentleman who we had a small tumor right here. After 3 months of treating this tumor endoscopically and removing it through the mouth, see we have a little bit of the Barrett's left over here and here, but we've removed the tumor in this area. Then just this area here, we can just treat was spot on, just what we talked about. Remember that ablation where we burn the rest of the esophagus? Because it's no longer cancer, just those precancerous cells that we want to get rid of so they don't develop cancer in the future. So after 3 months, we're just able to burn this with that ablative device. So after 9 months, we have this little strip left, and we're able to burn it as well. So in summary, what I want to say is that the esophagus and upper stomach cancer is on the rise, and this is primarily due to obesity. Smoking doesn't help. I'm not saying, we can go out and go smoking. It definitely makes things worse, but the main driver behind this is obesity, and that causes heartburn, that causes reflux. Even if you don't have symptoms, sometimes you can get a heartburn and you can get reflux even if you don't have significant symptoms. Most esophagogastric cancer is detected later. And we have had made incredible improvements. Even at McGill, we've developed a new standard for type of chemotherapy. That some people in the audience has family members who were part of the study themselves. We've shown that we've improved the survival twofold to threefold. We still have a long way to go for advanced cancers. And it's more important, if we can, to identify people who are at risk. And if we're able to identify people who are at risk, we can identify those that can lead to early diagnosis. And we really know if we can find patients who have Barrett's esophagus, we know who those are. We can survey them. We can look at their under endoscopy every three years to make sure they don't develop those areas that are dysplastic or slightly those cells start to change. We can use those advanced imaging techniques that we've learned in Japan in order to help us identify areas that are just starting to change. And if we can find those early cancers, there really is light at the end of the scope because we have changed things significantly. When I first started here 9 years ago, I trained in Hong Kong and I started working here, everyone who had those early cancers underwent surgery. And it is a big operation. We do it well, but it is still a very big operation. There's something else that we can do to prevent that. It'll be a huge advance. We improve the quality of life and we're able to leave the esophagus in. Patients who have an endoscopic removal of an early tumor go home the same day. They feel like they've had just a gastroscopy and that's it. So we can either burn through the, if it's early tumor, we can burn it if it's have those premalignant cells, or we can actually remove it. And that's a huge advance. I think that's a great improvement that we can offer to our patients. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you, Lorenzo. Our next speaker will be Dr. Prasanto Chaudhuri. He's an associate professor of surgery and oncology here at McGill University, at the McGill University Health Center. He's the associate director of general surgery at the Royal Vic, and he's also a hepatobiliary transplant surgeon at the Royal Vic. His talk will be entitled Management of Liver Metastases, because the liver really is a common site for spread of tumors that arise in the gastrointestinal tract.
Good evening, everyone. I'd like to thank you all for coming tonight. I must say that I lecture in this room relatively regularly to medical students, and I've never had quite so many people in front of me. So you'll forgive me if I'm a little bit nervous. tonight, I'd like to talk to you a little bit, or I've been asked to talk to you a little bit about the management of liver metastases, and we're going to talk primarily about metastases from colon cancer. But to begin with, I wanted to talk a little bit about colon cancer. Colon cancer itself is actually a fairly lethal cancer. It is the second highest cause of cancer-related mortality in men and the third highest in women. And if we look at how that spreads out over our population as we age, this graph shows the incidence of different cancers as we get older. You can see that by the time we are in our 50s and 60s and above, it is the number two most lethal and most common cancer in both men and women. So this is your colon, or a rough approximation thereof. It's the end of your intestine, and you can get cancers anywhere within this organ. They're spread primarily in the lower parts of the colon, but you also have some on what's called the right side as well. So that probably begs a question. How do you know you have colon cancer? Well, there's no clear 100% symptom, but certainly if you're starting to have changes in your bowel habits, periods of constipation alternating with diarrhea, change in the caliber of your stool, probably not the most nice conversation for a supper time talk, but nonetheless. If you ever have blood in the stool and not had that before, sometimes feelings of constipation, of crampy abdominal pain, of more advanced disease, you might start to have some weight loss. So these are things that might trigger you or your family doctor to try to investigate this a little bit more. So how's your doctor going to figure this out? He's got magic fingers. No, that's unfortunately not true. But he is going to have to examine you. And in some cases, even with his finger, he'll be able to find that. But really, we rely on colonoscopy. And colonoscopy is very much like some of the images that Dr. Ferry was showing you, only from the other end of the camera, going through the entire colon that we see there, looking for polyps, precancerous lesions, or in some cases, cancers themselves, and those will be biopsied. when should you get your colonoscopy? Well, the current recommendations in Quebec is that if you are 50 or older, you should seek out a screening colonoscopy, or if you've had a first-degree relative who's had a colon cancer. Then what you should do is have a colonoscopy about 10 years younger than the age of that first-degree relative. So, for example, if your father had colon cancer at the age of 50, then you should start your screening 10 years earlier than that at age 40. So now I've got a colon cancer. What happens next? Well, you'll likely be referred to a surgeon. Not me. I don't do colon operations, at least not on a regular basis, but to a colorectal surgeon or a general surgeon. And they will work you up. They're going to stage the disease. We'll come back to that concept in a moment. So they'll try to image your chest in some way, make sure it hasn't spread to the chest. They're going to get a scan of the abdomen and pelvis to look where it is in the abdomen. For rectal cancers, they will specifically seek out to do an MRI because that's important at the staging in the treatment of rectal cancer. And they'll probably check your blood for some markers which can be associated with colon cancer. Once they've done all this and they've deemed that this colon cancer came out, then you'll go on to have your operation. Now, once it's out, and based on the stage of the disease, based on how advanced the disease is locally, or if it has spread to things like lymph nodes or other organs, then there'll be a decision made about whether or not you need to have other treatment, meaning chemotherapy. So what is staging? Staging is a way for us to describe how advanced a cancer is. And I don't know how well this shows, but there are various staging systems. Some are related to the depth and the size. But the standard one that we use in most cancers is a TNN staging system, based on characteristics of the tumor in terms of size and depth of invasion, based on the presence or absence of tumor in the lymph nodes in the region, and M for metastatic disease that has spread. So how do cancers get around? Well, cancers can grow locally. They can just get big and big and big and spread and invade into things that are adjacent to where they started. They can spread through our lymphatics, but when we're talking about the liver, they usually get there through the blood. So all of the blood that comes out of the gastrointestinal tract drains into something called the portal vein, and the portal vein is the main inflow of blood into the liver. And these tumors will then, in some cases, spread there. If we were to look more specifically at the TNM, or the staging system for colon cancer, you can see that the T part is based on the tumor, how far it invades, the N part based on which nodes, and the M part based on whether it's spread elsewhere. And you put those together and you get these famous numbers, the stage numbers. Broadly, stage 1 and 2 depend really on the size of the tumor. Stage 3 means that you have nodes involved. And at stage 4, it means you have spread to other organs or metastatic disease. And that basic concept is true for all of the TNM staging systems. What's the implication of stage? So, even within the subclasses of stage 3, the lower the stage, the longer or the more likely you are to be alive 5 years after your diagnosis. When we get into more advanced stages, so now we're looking at all four stages, and the dashed red line being overall survival, you can see that stage 4 disease or metastatic disease really portends a much more grim prognosis than any other stage. Okay. So now the question is, how common are metastases in colon cancer? So it's estimated that about half of patients with colon cancer will at some point in their disease develop metastasis to the liver. About 20% of patients will have those metastases when they present with their tumor for the first time. So it's a very common problem in colon cancer, and as you can see from those graphs, it really does portend the more grim side of the spectrum. So what happens then? What happens if I get liver metastases? Well, at that point, you're going to come, hopefully, to see someone like me and my team, who are hepatobiliary oncology teams, right? And we'll see you and we'll assess you. And what we'll look for is, again, another kind of staging, this time to look really in-depth at the liver, but also to make sure there is no cancer outside of just the liver. And why is this so important? Well, it's important because a liver resection or a surgery on the liver is the only option we have that has a chance to cure you if you have developed metastasis to the liver. Some images of what that might look like. On the left-hand panel, we have a CT scan. And on the right, you see an image from the operation where we're taking out a fairly large portion of someone's liver. And the liver is a wonderful, wonderful organ. Because even as the ancient Greeks knew and Prometheus knew, it regenerates. Now, I have to clarify regeneration. If I take out someone's right liver, that right liver is never growing back. However, the rest of the liver that we leave behind is going to grow. It's going to grow to the point that it weighs, within a month or two, close to 90% of the weight of the liver before surgery. So it's a really remarkable regenerative capacity that the liver has that allows us to operate and do some of the more complex operations that we do on livers. And so this is a similar case at the end of it, and you can see that we really have left this very relatively tiny piece of liver behind. But rest assured, this will grow, and within a month or so, will weigh almost as much as that whole liver did before. Which now begs the question, can I have surgery for my liver? And I think that we can answer that in a couple of ways. One is we can look at what people have done over time in terms of reporting their outcomes after liver resection. And so here, I'll draw your attention to this pink column, which is that this is a big operation. It's kind of like an open heart surgery in terms of its ampleur, its scope. There is a risk of dying from this kind of operation. In centers of excellence, that risk is around 2-2.5%. Why do we take that risk? Well, we take that risk because on the other side, there's about a 40%, and in some more recent series, up to 60% chance of being alive 5 years after this operation if you make it through it. And I contrast this with the survival curve I showed you before for stage 4 disease, which really portended a very grim prognosis with virtually nobody surviving to the 5-year mark. So surgery can have a dramatic impact in prolonging your life, or in some cases even curing you if you've developed liver metastases. There is a caveat to that too, unfortunately, and that is that only about 1 in 5 patients who has liver metastases at the time they present to a surgeon is actually a candidate for an operation. The good news, however, is that we do have some tools in our arsenal to try to increase that number. With our team, with the oncology team, in some cases chemotherapy can be used, ablative strategies, much the same technologies that Dr. Ferry presented, and in some cases stage resection. And I'll talk about each of these things very briefly. In the chemotherapy arena, what's really changed and what's really allowed the field of liver surgery for colon cancer to evolve is in the last 10-15 years the development of a new series of drugs and combinations of drugs, as well as targeted agents going after specific molecules, or in some cases antibodies going after specific receptors, that have dramatically increased the response rate to chemotherapy. So in the late 80s, early 90s, we were working out with a single agent only, essentially. The response rate was less than 20%. With these new, in some cases, quadruplets or 4 kinds of drugs being used simultaneously, we can raise the response rate to chemotherapy to the range of 60-70%. What can chemotherapy do on its own? So if you have liver metastases and you're going to be receiving chemotherapy only because you're not able to have an operation, well, we can probably prolong your life to about 2 years on average. However, if we can get you to an operation, we can sometimes convert someone who is not resectable when we first meet them to a resectable state and offer them surgery later on. And once we do this, survivals are fairly similar to the people who had liver resection up front. We can use some adjunctive technologies. And so Dr. Ferry mentioned radiofrequency ablation, and that's probably the main ablative technique that we can use. This is a technique that was originally developed by the cardiologists and has now been adapted and adopted by a number of other fields. And in this case, an antenna is placed into a tumor, and the tumor is heated up with radiofrequency energy to the point that we induce coagulative necrosis. Essentially, we cook it in situ. This can be done either in the operating room or by the radiologists. Has fairly few complications, but in our context, really it hasn't shown a clear survival benefit. So from ablative technologies, our long-term survival outcomes are still being defined. We know that for very small tumors, single small tumors, not generally metastatic disease, but primary cancers of the liver, very small ones can probably be cured with this. We know that we can't cure very large lesions. And what defines very small and very large? Somewhere between 2 and 3 centimeters. So under 2 centimeters, we stand a good chance of sterilizing something. Over 3 centimeters, there's a reasonably high chance that it will come back. And that's reported anywhere between 10 and 47% recurrence over time. So on that basis, we don't recommend RFA in most cases as a curative intent surgery or a procedure, unless you're doing it as part of a research protocol, or if a patient can't undergo surgery. So if they've already had several liver resections and we need to deal with a recurrence, we might use that kind of technology. We do also use it sometimes as an adjunct to surgery. So let's say someone has a large tumor on the right side of the liver and a very small one on the left side of the liver. We may take out the right side of the liver and burn the remaining tumor on the left side if it's in that small category that we think that we can cure with one of these ablative techniques. We have other ablation tools. Microwave energy, same thing you have in your kitchen. Well, that comes out of an antenna too, and we can take that antenna and stick it into a liver tumor and cook the liver tumor much as you would cook something in your own microwave at home. And we can do it with the opposite side of the spectrum. We can freeze things as well. And so cryoablation for tumors is something that's making a bit of a comeback. and our radiology department is soon to acquire one of these cryoablation machines for us to work with. The last thing I want to talk about is staged liver resection. So sometimes we can't get all the tumor out in a single operation. But because of the livers, and that may be because there are too many, they're on both sides of the liver, or taking all of the tumors out at once wouldn't leave enough liver behind. In these contexts, we can take advantage of the liver's natural ability to heal itself, to grow, to regenerate, so that we can do one operation, let the liver recover, and come back and do a second operation at a later time. So that allows for regeneration between the procedures. It permits us to do much more extensive liver resections while ensuring that we always save an adequate volume of functional liver for patients as we go along. And even with these staged operations, we can achieve 5-year survivals that are equivalent to patients having a single operation. So I thought I'd end just by showing a few pictures of a staged operation. So this is a gentleman I operated on 7 or 8 years ago who had a colon cancer that had spread to the liver, and he had the metastasis when he first presented. At his first operation, we took out this left portion of the liver here, or you don't see it there because it's gone, but these metal staples here are evidence of our passing, at the same time as the colorectal surgeon took out the colon cancer. He then went on to get some chemotherapy, and then we tried to trick the liver into growing. We knew that we wanted to take this right part of the liver out, but that would really have left only this little sliver of liver in the middle, and so we wanted to trick that liver into growing. So what we can do is block that portal vein that feeds that area of liver that we're going to take out. So we sort of trick the liver to thinking it's already gone, and the part of liver whose portal vein is still has flow in it starts to grow, starts to regenerate, even before we get to the operation. And so he did undergo a second operation, had a fairly uneventful course, and had some chemotherapy thereafter. This is roughly what that looks like. It's not him, but it's another case where we've taken in the past the left liver out, and on a second operation come back and taken the right out. So we're really left with just this middle hunk of liver, which will grow and grow and grow, so that it looks like this. So over time, this liver, it's clearly not normal. It's clearly not regenerated completely. But in terms of weight and function, it has regenerated dramatically from that scan that I first showed you. So this is one line of resection. This is the other. So we very much think about the segmental anatomy of the liver when we're planning operations like this. And this little cartoon kind of shows the procedure that that patient had gone through, where we started with all 8 anatomic segments of the liver, cut out this lateral part, block the portal vein to start the process of regeneration here, and then took out these 4 segments on the right side here, and then you have that middle portion of the liver that's really grown and grown and grown afterwards. So, in conclusion, I'd like to say that although my practice is largely patients with stage 4 disease, I think there is hope for these patients. The care of patients with metastatic colon cancer is becoming increasingly complex. The indications for surgery are broadening, and more patients are becoming resectable through these techniques and chemotherapies that we've been discussing. There are several keys to the successful management of someone who has this kind of disease, and it's really hinging on the early involvement of a multidisciplinary team. You know, as you can see, getting someone through a series of operations and procedures requires very close cooperation between surgeons, a colon surgeon, a liver surgeon, sometimes a lung surgeon, an oncology team, in some cases a radiation oncology team, the interventional radiologist, the diagnostic radiologists, the pivot nurses in oncology, and the clinical coordinators. And really, the success that we have is because we're able to get involved in the care of these patients early on, work in a multidisciplinary fashion to try to coordinate care with referring centers and for patients. I'd like to acknowledge a small part of the team that I work with, you know, a group of surgeons, a group of radiologists, a group of oncologists, trainees, researchers, and so forth. And we're all looking forward, 11 months and 26 days and an odd number of hours, to being able to move into our new digs and help take care of you there. So with that, I'd like to thank you very much and be happy to take some questions later on in the evening. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Prasad. That was great. So our next speaker is Dr. Nicole Beauchemin. And Nicole is actually a full professor here at McGill University in the departments of biochemistry, oncology, and medicine. And her laboratory is actually right in this building on the 7th floor. And she's going to be talking to us about the processes that are involved when colorectal cancer metastasizes to the liver.
A few familiar faces. For those of you who think I do everything around here, I'm sometimes a patient, I'm sometimes a moderator, tonight I'm actually a scientist. Thank you for introducing some of my slides, so I will be able to skip over a few. So as Dr. Chaudhary just explained, there are various stages in the development of colon cancer and liver metastasis. And these go through four different stages, the last stage being liver metastasis. What he didn't mention, and what we basic scientists like to look at, is there are some genes that are changed associating with this. We already know quite a bit about this because ever since almost mid-80s, there's been a lot of work that's been done all over the world to try and identify which genes might actually be driving the development of colon cancer, and now we're moving to which genes might be driving the metastasis to the liver. So we know of this gene here, APC, which will convert a simple polyp or a normal epithelium into a simple polyp. We know of another important gene, which is a RAS, which is a very small molecule but that plays a crucial role in the cell relative to proliferation. And when RAS gets overheated or overactivated, it will essentially drive the small polyp, which is essentially benign at that point, to become more malignant. And so on and so forth, all the way to the end. In the liver metastasis, what we know at this point is that there are at least two, and certainly more, but I want to pull your attention to these two because I'll be coming back to it at the end of the lecture. The gene is called SMAD4 or TGF-beta receptor 2. As you've already found out, liver metastasis is not essentially very curable. It will take some time with the new surgical techniques, new discoveries. It certainly helps the patients proceed along for quite some time, but unfortunately, we need a little more than surgery. So what happens at the cellular level or at the tumor level is once you have actually a tumor that develops, blood vessels will actually come in, and the blood vessels are there and will sort of insert into the tumor because they need to feed the tumor. And so to bring the nutrients, you need to have a pipeline of some sort to bring in the nutrients. So this is a blood vessel. It's lined with endothelial cells, which are sort of like a wall that prevents all of the immune cells that are traveling through our through the blood vessels from leaking out. At one point, the tumor essentially overgrows its original niche and will have to essentially propagate from the original tumor. So this would be essentially colon. It's going to travel through the blood vessels, and it will at one point force its entry. We call this intravasation into the blood vessels. It will travel through the blood vessels. It will sometimes be complex with some of the immune cells. It will arrest. It will sort of take a pause and sort of stay there for a little while. And eventually, when it gets to a secondary site, in this case the liver, it will do the reverse process, which is to sort of skim through the blood vessel, the endothelial cells, and extravasate into the liver. A few cells make it through the process. Essentially, we consider that from an original tumor, maybe 0.1% of the cells actually make it to the liver. Okay? So a lot of them will actually die as they travel through the blood vessels and never actually stick to the liver hepatocytes. Okay, so what happens in terms of cellular processes? So I'm going to talk to you a little bit about cell adhesion molecules, my favorite molecules. So cell adhesion molecules are glues. Most of the protein actually lies outside the cell, and they connect with the similar protein lying outside another cell. So they essentially kiss. Okay? And once they kiss, they sort of send the signal inside the cell to change a number of processes. If you have an event, a cancer event, that actually occurs, some of these cell adhesion molecules will disengage one from the other, will actually decrease at the cell surface. So if there's no glue to stick them together, they're free to travel, which is essentially what they will do. They will travel, they will essentially travel through the blood vessels, and they will reach the liver. Once they reach the liver, it's a very comfortable place, the liver. They like to live there. So they're going to re-express another set of adhesion molecules and stick to the liver hepatocytes. So they can live in one place and be a tumor cell, and they can live in the liver and become a metastatic cell. In the meantime, they've changed a lot of their program because they were a static cell. They had to start moving, and then they have to stop moving and establish. So, my laboratory for the last 26 years has worked on another type of a cell adhesion molecule. Some of you may be familiar with Dr. Phil Gold, who's an institution here in Montreal. And you had it on your slide, the CEA levels. So CEA is this cell adhesion molecule. It was discovered here by Dr. Gold in 1963. He didn't know what the protein actually looked like. I did that for him. But what I also did is I discovered a whole big family of proteins that pretty much look similar to it. So one of the things you can see is that most of the proteins actually are outside the cell. A few of them have projections that go inside the cell. So what do these... So these three cell adhesion molecules, CCAM1, CCAM5, CCAM6, are those that we know have an activity in liver metastasis. So, how do they stick together? My laboratory works on CCAM1 because it's the first one, because it's the most important, and because it actually has a inside portion that gives it the opportunity to connect with a whole bunch of proteins and transmit a message. It lives as a cell adhesion molecule, but it has two sort of opposite way of doing it. It can essentially be a cell adhesion molecule on the same cell. We call this cis. Or it can connect with a whole bunch of other cells that also carry CCAM1. This we call trans. Because it has an inside portion, and because it has particular motifs on the inside, it can connect with a number of proteins. But it can also crosstalk to other proteins lying on the cell surface. These are the Morag's favorite proteins, the growth factor receptors. These guys are the drivers of the cell. They like to connect with ligands, which essentially turn them on, which turn on a whole program that usually leads to proliferation and transmission of signals. But CCAM1 is essentially important in this. So, the first question that we asked is the expression of CCAM1 on a number of cell types in the body, does that have anything to do with its development of metastasis? We call this the soil effect. Which cells in the body actually carry CCAM1? Well, the endothelial cells, blood vessels, actually have quite a bit of it. And then most of the immune cells also carry CCAM1. So how do we know whether these cells play a role in the development of metastasis? So we developed a mouse model. So this is a genetically modified mouse model that does not express CCAM1 anywhere on any of its cells. And what we did, we took some very aggressive colorectal cancer cells in the mouse. We inject these cells in the spleen. Within 3 minutes, the cells will move from the spleen through the portal vein and will reside in the liver. And after 14 days, they essentially develop metastasis on the liver, which is what you see here. So WT is essentially a very normal mouse that does carry CCAM1. CC1-minus is our modified mouse without CCAM1. So you don't have to be a real scientist to see what's happening. There's almost no metastasis on this mouse, on this liver. In fact, when we quantify everything, we actually saw that there was a 90% decrease of metastasis in the CCAM1-minus. And those few metastases that we did pick up, the size was definitely decreased. Interesting. So, what is the role of the endothelial cell in this? So, we went to see Lorenzo in his laboratory. So, Lorenzo has this fantastic setup. So, here's my patient with the liver lying over the microscope. You can see he's anesthetized. He's got a cannula running in. And you actually can see his liver over the microscope. So what happens, the cells have gone through the blood vessels, and what we're looking for is, if CCAM wasn't as important on the endothelial cells, will we see a difference? So we put a green tag on our cells to be able to follow them, and what we see is more cells in the normal mouse with less cells in the mice that are genetically modified, which means that a lot less cells arrest in the blood vessels. If they don't arrest, they actually go through and they will die, which is what we quantified here. So they don't like, in a genetically modified mouse, they do not like to stay around and they die more frequently, which means we get a lot less metastasis. Now, I told you earlier, immune system has a lot of CCAM1. So how are we going to demonstrate that maybe the immune cells are important? So we do what happens to a number of patients. We actually use the CC1 or the wild-type mice, and we essentially destroy their immune system. Then we take the immune system of this mouse, put it into here, this one, put it into here. We let them go for 2-3 months so they reconstitute their immune system. So they've got everything except the immune system of the other mouse. Then we start the process and we look at whether or not there's going to be metastasis. So what happens is essentially we can see if you put the wild type back into the wild type, you have a lot of metastasis. If you put the CC1 into the CC1, a lot less metastasis. These are our controls. If you put the wild type into the CC1, the immune system of the wild type is so important that it will help to form metastasis. And if you do the reverse, you essentially reproduce this pattern, which confirms that the immune system is very important. We actually looked for which type of immune cells was important, and we found a subset, CD11BGR1. I'm sure you're going to want to remember this. They're called myeloid-derived suppressor cells, and they're very, very important. In fact, if we purify these cells and put them back in, we can essentially show that they were the cells, they are the cells, which are the most important in this context to help in metastasis. Now, genetically modified mice. Yeah, we can't do this with a patient, right? Is there something we could do that would be similar? So the experiment was done by some of our colleagues where they took an antibody to CCAM1 and they essentially treated normal mice. They put in the tumors and they're looking for growth of the tumors over a certain number of days. If you treat the tumors with an antibody that's irrelevant, not to CCAM1, they grow very well. If you put in an antibody to CCAM1, the tumor actually shrinks and does not grow as fast. And the same cells, those myeloid-derived suppressor cells, are definitely in lesser numbers than what you would see in a circumstance like this, which indicates that potentially there might be some patients for whom treating with an anti-CCAM1 antibody would essentially decrease their metastatic load. Now, we've looked at what happens to cells that are inside the body and that are sort of playing a role to develop the metastasis. What happens if the cancer cell, we had started with cancer cells that did not have CCAM1. So we are able to sort of fool around and put CCAM1 back on the tumor cell, which is what we did here. So what happens now if you try and develop metastasis with these novel cancer cells that express CCAM1? So no CCAM1, you get a lot of metastasis. Put back CCAM1, you have a lot less metastasis. And we fooled around, we tinkered around with mutants in the cytoplasmic domain, which essentially rescued part of the phenotype. So it's not just on the endogenous cells, it's also what happens on the tumor cell that's essentially important. So what was important? So we spent 2 years looking for what were the major changes. And we came up with a number of very important candidates. There was a lot less of a transcription factor that's called STAT3. There was a lot less of a chemokine that's called CCL2. It was a lot more of a protein that's called Decorin, beautiful name. And we actually, this guy, we spent so much time on this one. This is a tyrosine kinase receptor, one of Morag's favorite kind of molecules. And we saw a significant decrease in the activity of this. So it's one thing to find them. You also have to validate them. That's what took 2 years. Okay. So just to explain what this might mean. So the FA2 receptor lies at the surface of the cell. It likes to interact with the ligand. So here's an analogy that I thought of. This is the prime minister. This is the leader of the opposition who has engaged the prime minister into essentially developing a program. The program is downstream here, our STAT3 molecule. That's the Ministry of Health. And Ministry of Health will most of the time do something and essentially send to the hospitals whatever is necessary to improve the healthcare system. Sometimes. Okay? A cell. So Prime Minister really likes the idea, goes for it, he gives the okay, the ministry activates, and eventually you get the production of this protein, which some must be doing something relative to metastasis. Now, you put CCAM1 into this cell. So CCAM1 is the finance minister. In the cell that carries CCAM1, there's a lot of this inhibitor called Decorin. These are the international quotation agencies that if CCAM1 is not sufficiently active in inhibiting the activity, these guys will definitely do it. So what happens there is there's decrease in the Prime Minister's project, there's decrease in funding to the health ministries, and there's decreased production back to the hospitals of whatever you need to get a better health system. So this is, in scientific terms, an inhibitory co-receptor, and this is a tyrosine kinase inhibitor. So is this important? Are these molecules important in liver metastasis? Well, fortunately, we went back to the literature and we found quite a few associations independent one of the other. So CCL2 is very important to promote the development of colorectal cancer liver metastasis. The EphRIN and FA2 family is important for invasion. The STAT3 is a marker of poor prognosis. And the Decorin is essentially also important, all independently. So what we're doing now, we got the results essentially yesterday, is to ask the question, do they cooperate? Do they collaborate? So we went to large databases with collaborators and looked and asked the question, are there patients out there that have all of these features? And yes, there are. Now, one of the questions that was very important, we worked with one cell line. Are there other cell lines that will have the same features? So we took another cell line and we repeated all this. We didn't see much of a difference. So that was pretty disappointing. So we asked the question, what's different between one cell line and the other cell line? What was different is essentially the SMAD4 gene, one of the ones that's essentially very responsible for developing metastasis, is completely different in one cell line and the other. Now, is this important? In colorectal cancer patients, there are 9% of the colorectal cancer patients that have a mutation in SMAD4. So those that have a mutation in SMAD4 and have CCAM1 should be doing much better, which is what we're looking for. So here's a few of the questions that are left to tackle. Essentially, we know that CCAM1, the one that has a long cytoplasmic domain, is expressed in the microenvironment and it contributes to the CRC metastasis. What is the status of CCAM1? It's MAP4 mutated patients. So here we're collaborating with the team of Dr. Peter Mitrakos and the hepatobiliary team to look at matched samples between the primary tumor that the patient's got, colorectal, and the liver metastasis that they've eventually developed, and see where is CCAM1, is it expressed, what does it correlate with? This is very important because I'm just showing you a little bit of the complexities we're facing. These are two very well-known colorectal, human colorectal cancer cell line. These are some of the genes that get mutated along the way. In some of them, you have mutations, whereas this has new mutation. It'll have another one here, but a different one here. Here it'll be mutated, but this one is wild type. So what is the contribution of each of these genes and how CCAM1 plays into this before we actually move to patients with questions such as, can it be used as a therapy in metastatic patients? Could it even be a good biomarker? One of the most difficult questions I've been told by clinicians is to know when the metastasis is actually progressing in the patients so that the clinicians can undertake the necessary procedures in terms of surgery. The only way to do this is to put these patients through MRI. You all know what that's like. You all know how long it is. You all know how expensive it is. If we had an easy test and we could follow the molecule along the way, we could probably be able to see and diagnose those that need therapy immediately or surgery immediately. So this is where we're moving to. I'd like to thank my team. The star here is Azadeh Arabzadeh. She did all of this work in the last 3.5 years. There's a few people from my lab sitting in the audience. Thank you very much. You've done a wonderful job.
Thank you, Nicole. So our final speaker tonight, we're very fortunate to have with us, is Susan Wehner, who is going to share her experiences with two brushes with cancer and how she's managed to deal with each of those instances. Susan is a certified natural health consultant and a practicing therapist who also holds a teaching degree from McGill University. And she's also recently added author to her list, and she's recently published a book entitled Resistance, A Story of Courage. Oh, Resilience, sorry. A story. We're used to thinking about resistance. Resilience, A Story of Courage and Triumph in the Face of Recurrent Cancer. And we're very, very happy to have you here to talk about your experience.
Yes, no, yes. First of all, I'm honored to have been asked to speak in the presence of such incredible scientists. I'm going to start off by saying I know absolutely nothing. I'm simply a person who has had an awful lot of experiences, who's dealt with a lot of garbage, and who managed to come out the other side. And if tonight I can leave you with the ability that you know that you have inside yourself so much more capacity than you would ever believe possible, then for me, tonight will be an incredible success. A diagnosis of cancer can weaken the knees of even the strongest of us. It literally takes your breath away. There is such an incredible loss of innocence, a belief in your body, a trust that your life will ever get back to normal. It's terrifying. And I don't think that there's any other experience I've had in my life that's quite like that. 25 years ago, I was diagnosed with colon cancer. I was only 36 years old at the time, and my daughters were 8, 12, and almost 14. My husband's in the audience with me tonight, and you know, it would sound very romantic to say that I chose to fight and to live because I was madly in love with him, which does happen to be true. But you know, as an adult, I knew he could handle himself and he could move forward. It was my girls. They needed a mother. They needed somebody there to continue to teach them so that they could learn the values that I really wanted to instill upon them, in them, and make them strong and independent women. It's very hard today, you know, when you're diagnosed with an illness. Not only do you have to deal with the fact that you're terrified and you're scared, but today the doctors expect you to participate fully right from the beginning. And it's hard. You don't really know where to go, and you don't really know what to do. And it's extremely difficult to make a decision when you're so frightened that you don't have the capacity to do so. So my suggestion to you is to make sure that you bring an extra pair of ears along with you. Because chances are you really won't remember anything that you're told, especially when you're first diagnosed. And you really need to have the support of people around you to be able to take notes, to gather information, and to be there all the way through to help you through this illness. I had colon cancer. I had a bowel resection, and I had 6 months of chemotherapy. And my doctor gave me 95% chance to live a disease-free life. Well, almost 5 years later, I had to have a lung removed. That 95% chance did not work. And if you think that having cancer once is scary, having cancer twice is one step closer to the grave, and it is terrifying. But what I did over the 5 years between the two cancers was go back to school. I educated myself in every single thing I could learn, in every healing modality outside of traditional medicine, not because I didn't have good care. I had excellent care. But because it wasn't enough for me. I was not just a physical body. I was broken inside. My spirit felt shattered. My emotions were frayed. And my soul felt as if I had a scarlet letter literally burnt across my chest. So I studied Indian medicine. I studied Chinese medicine. I studied naturopathy, homeopathy. I learned. I became my own science experiment. I did some things that I would never, ever recommend anybody doing. Because let me tell you, drinking your own urine is not exactly a tasty treat. But I felt at least I was doing something for me. I did not want to play a wait-and-see game. I didn't want to wait and see what would happen if 5 years after the second cancer, a third cancer might rear its ugly little head. And I figured we do three things to ourselves. We put thoughts in our minds, we put food in our body, and we exercise. I don't know what else we really do. So I decided to be that science experiment and work on improving all three things. I became a vegan for 5 years, and my poor husband gained 25 pounds running everywhere else and looking for food in all the wrong places because eating at home was not fun. Nobody wanted to come home. The kids refused to bring their friends home. And the truth was, I was longing for that occasional hall-dressed hot dog that I love to have once a year. I was devastated that I was sitting there living on my beans, not very happy. When I had a recurrence of cancer, I figured, well, that didn't work. Okay, what else could I do? I became the person who started actually listening to my body. I learned what my needs were. I learned to eat when I was hungry and to sleep when I was tired and to be able to function in a way that made sense to me. It doesn't mean living on a diet of garbage and junk food. It meant eating consciously and it meant living consciously. You're going to find that as you go through this process that there are so many suggestions out there. There are so many people out there offering anything. And a charismatic therapist combined with a vulnerable patient could lead you down a lot of not so good roads. So you may not have doctors who approve of everything you do. And I say to you, who gives a damn? Tell them anyway. If you get flack, it doesn't matter. But it is so important for them to understand what motivates us that if they can't necessarily offer us what we're looking for, we're going to go looking elsewhere. But do it smartly. Be monitored. Be conscious. And you don't really have to make best friends with any of them. Just do your absolute best. One of the things that was extremely valuable to me in my process was the idea of imagery and visualization. It helped me to be a much better person and to deal with illness in a much different way. So I'd like to ask you all if you would just give me a few minutes to close your eyes and go on a little journey with me and try something. Its intention is just to relax you, to calm you, to bring you to that place where you open yourself up to be receptive to possibility. And if you open your eyes and see me closing mine, it's because I'm going to be doing it with you. So close your eyes and just feel yourself supported by the chair. Allow your body to just relax into the chair. Allow your breath to become quiet. Just feel yourself gently and slowly letting go. I want you to imagine as you exhale, you let go of any stress that's bothering you, any tension, any worries, just for a moment. Just on the breath of an exhalation, let it go. And then I want you to imagine finding yourself in a forest. Smell the pine all around you. Hear the crunch underfoot as you walk. And somehow you're drawn along a path. And at the end of a path is the most incredible tree you've ever seen. It's early spring, and it still bears no leaves. But there's something about this tree that is majestic, that holds itself up with pride. And you choose to sit beside the tree. And as you lean against it, you find yourself falling asleep and being transported into the center of the tree. Down, down, down you go into the rooting system, into what looks like a sea of tributaries. As you imagine that throughout this winter, the tree has managed to get all its needs met. It's managed to stretch and reach through its roots to make sure its vitamins, its minerals, whatever nutrients it needs to thrive has been gotten. And although it may not have any leaves, the beauty of the tree is it hardly needs any. The tree is like us. It has the capacity to become. It's spring. You're ready to burst into life. The tree is ready to just spring, literally, and blossom, taking with it potential, taking with it opportunity, taking with it choice. And we are like that tree. As the springtime approaches, we have the capacity to begin anew. Each and every day, we start fresh the moment we open our eyes. We can choose to take in the nutrients that are important to us, the thoughts we think to help make it through the day, the foods we ingest to help our body be strong, the exercise we need to do to allow us to move freely. And we need to create the best internal environment into which any medicine we choose to take has the best chance of being effective. We need to go inside, deeply, inside ourselves, and find those things that make sense to us. And we can. We have so much more capacity than we would ever believe possible. We have so much more resilience than we know to be possible. all we have to do is go deep inside and try. There are no absolutes in life. There are just opportunities. And opportunities create the kind of life we need to live. So believe, have faith, trust, and go for it. Because the truth is, you have absolutely nothing to lose. 5 years after the diagnosis of colon cancer, I had the whole right lung removed. Doctors didn't believe it would be possible for a 41-year-old woman to expand a 45% capacity to over 90%, but I expanded it to almost 95%. I have a massive lung inside this chest. And the reason that I believe that I did it was nobody told me that I could not until after I did it. And I remember at that time speaking to my pulmonologist and saying to him, use me as a science experiment. Teach your students. Use me as an example. And he said to me, I can't. You've done so many crazy things throughout this journey, I don't even know where to begin. But if I get sick, I'm coming to see you. Just know that you may have cancer. Your body may be cancering at the moment, but don't become defined by what you're dealing with. You are who you are. The important thing that we need and the important thing that keeps us alive is the support we have from one another. We need to be able to look to our left and look to our right, and even if those people near us are strangers, to reach out and touch one another. Because that's all we've got, is one another. The gift I have of being here, I cannot express. I thank you so much for having me. And I just pray that you guys continue to do the work that you're doing, because we need you so badly. Thank you.
I'd like to thank all of our speakers for excellent talks. And now I could ask if there's anyone that had questions written out, if someone will come along and gather them up, and we'll bring them down, and we can pose them to the panel members. Under what conditions can an inoperable liver tumor or metastasis become operable with chemotherapy? Thank you. Santo.
So generally it's because they have shrunk sufficiently to allow us to preserve some of the important architecture within the liver, be it a blood supply, a bile duct, or outflow of blood. So if a tumor shrinks and moves it away from that kind of structure, or shrinks enough to allow us to preserve additional liver volume, which would allow the resection to take place.
Dr. Ferry, what is the usual or recommended treatment and treatment sequence for esophageal cancer when lesions are found in the brain or if it's metastasized?
In the brain or?
In the brain is the specific question.
When the tumor has spread to the brain, it's really we try to treat symptoms primarily. So our goal of therapy is to give the best quality of life for as long as possible. So if those lesions in the brain are symptomatic, we tend to treat that with primarily radiation therapy. Then if the esophagus cancer is causing difficulty swallowing, we will target that with either a tube placed endoscopically, like with a gastroscope, and we try to spread it, or we add some treatment, like local treatment with like radiation therapy in order to open that up. Okay. But it's primarily symptom-based.
Okay. Here's another question. I'm beginning to have chronic heartburn.
Uh-oh.
What do I do?
Like me, I too have chronic heartburn. we have to recognize that heartburn is extremely common. It's 25 to 35% of the population does have heartburn at some point, and regular heartburn at least once a week. We start by just symptom-based treatments, and usually that means we're trying to reduce the acid that's in the stomach. That can be done with foods, decrease certain foods that increase acidity, try to stay away from them, eating certain times during the day, stopping smoking. Smoking is never good at any time, but it also can increase acidity. But also we usually start with some medications, and those, if despite those measures, those non-medication measures don't work, we usually start some medication to decrease the acid. And we don't usually recommend undergoing a scope unless you have heartburn, quite severe heartburn, for at least 10 years.
Nicole, here's a question for you. Do cancer metastases always occur through the bloodstream? Are there other known routes through which metastasis can occur?
From the primary to the secondary site, it's the main line, right? It could go through the lymphatic vessels, which is sort of quite similar to the blood vessels in many respects, but essentially it will take one of the two routes and will be delivered to the secondary niche. Now, what defines the secondary niche? Why certain cancers go to the liver and the lung and others go to the brain is still a bit of a mystery for all of us. Right, Peter?
That's right. Does the colon cancer have to be removed prior to liver resection therapies?
Certainly the standard would be to have the colon removed first, but we recognize increasingly in the liver surgery community that there are some cases where there may be an advantage to operating on the liver first. And those are in cases where we fear that we might lose control of the liver in the time it would take someone to have a colon operation and recover from a colon operation. And in some cases, there are some institutions which are looking at this in the context of rectal cancer as well. So I'd say the general answer is yes, the colon comes out before the liver. In some rare cases, we might consider taking the liver out first.
Okay. Susan, a question for you. Not vegan anymore. Do you eat meat, beef? How often? What's your diet now, I think is the question.
I absolutely eat everything, but I do it very consciously, and I do things occasionally. I think that for me, I was brought up in a way that was very fortunate. We were poor, but my uncle ran a fruit and vegetable distributing company. So most of our plate, I would say 70% of our plate, was vegetables and fruits. And I mean, at 61, I believe in doing the same thing. I think that most of your food should be fruits and vegetables, grains, nuts, and seeds, and just a small portion of animal protein. And if you do that, I think it's really, really difficult not to be healthy, because what you're doing is you're eating real food. And you know, there are times where meat is so essential. In Chinese medicine, meat can be a blood tonic. You know, you make special soups with things, and you need some meat for iron deficiencies. I mean, there's times where you really need to eat well, but eating consciously is what it's all about. It's not the specifics. There's a great book by Mark David called Nourishing Wisdom. And he says the attitude with which you eat is sometimes just as important, if not more important, than what you eat.
Dr. Ferry, is Barrett's esophagus condition reversible naturally?
That's an interesting point. Some people believe it can be if you get rid of the acid. There have been some instances where it can regress back to normal. I'd say that's rare. So most of the time, it is, once it's there, it's there to stay.
Okay.
Here's maybe a question for either of the surgeons. The specialized equipment they use for non-invasive surgery, does this have to go through some sort of formal testing or approval? Or are these largely experimental? Or maybe you could take us through that process.
I think that's a very good point, the regulatory. And up until recently, I understand, the FDA, these instruments were relatively fast-tracked. But now, over the past 2 or 3 years, the regulatory bodies in both the States and Canada have made them quite rigorous process in order to get these technologies approved. What that does is delay the time that they actually get to the patient, but it does ensure safety. I think that's that correct?
That's absolutely correct.
To what extent did genetics and family history increase the risk of esophageal and gastric cancers?
It has been more and more recognized that there are some some genetic components of both esophagus and stomach cancer. Stomach cancer is better recognized, but is also found that less than 5% of all stomach cancers are hereditary. What appears to be more hereditary is the fact of the way that we respond to acid. Some people have an acid response in their esophagus in which it just burns it, and other people have one where it burns it and then it progresses to the changes to Barrett's. So that seems to be, there may be some hereditary component to that, but it's still not known.
Does celiac disease impact on colorectal cancer or other GI cancers?
I have no idea.
Actually, I don't either.
So that's the
I'll
one
have
that's
to look that up. So that's the winner in the.
That's right.
Yeah, I don't know. You win. The answer to.
Susan.
In principle, celiac disease will create a very inflammatory situation, and at least in mouse models, and also recognized, for instance, with the inflammatory bowel disease. I have a student writing a thesis on this now, so I sort of have looked into this. And yes, in principle, it could take a long time. It could depend on the genes that you have endogenously. But I would believe that it could be a predisposition. It makes you more prone to it.
Question for you, Susan. What was the first alternative therapy that you had tried or chose to study, and why did you make that selection?
I was very, very brave. I actually chose to do something that my oncologist formulated a group to not allow it to be given at McGill or any of the teaching hospitals here, and it was a product called 714X. It was something that was created by a biochemist named Gaston Nessens. The reason that I chose to do it was I couldn't understand how twice having cancer, my bloods were always perfect. There was no indicator ever that there was anything askew in my body. And when I went and I had this particular test done before I started taking the product, I could see all kinds of things in a live blood analysis that were very strange, that I really didn't understand. But all of a sudden, I could see that everything was not all perfect inside my body. And as the time progressed, my blood seemed to clear, and the cells, instead of being clumpy and stuck together, started to free flow, and they looked better. I have to tell you that I will never, ever know if any of the things that I tried actually impacted my survival so many years later. But what I can tell you is that it made me feel at least that I was doing something for myself.
Nicole, can you discuss aspects of immunotherapy as it might relate to colorectal cancer or colorectal cancer metastasis?
So the same CEA that you saw on the slides, the grandfather in terms, historically at least, of the discovery, for the last, for sure, 15 if not 20 years, has been essentially one of the targets for immunotherapy. Reason being, it is very low abundance in normal colon, but it just can, it becomes totally overwhelming when there is a colorectal cancer developing. So what you want, one of the criteria is you want something that's going to be relatively unique. There are vaccine situations now that are beginning to work. I mean, they're not still for the general population. There are clinical trials in the United States with dendritic cells that have been essentially prepared quite specially targeting CEA that seems to work. Within my expectation would be that within most likely the next 5 years, we'll start seeing the first immunotherapy trials in colorectal cancer.
Dr. Ferry, you mentioned a number of specialized surgical techniques that are less invasive. The question is, why haven't other universities or institutions adopted this in a more widespread manner?
I think two of them is the first one is the ablation. Our colleagues to the south do use it quite aggressively, even more than in patients we wouldn't recommend it for at all. But it comes down to cost. So for the ablation, it was a priority at our institution that we make sure that we offer this because it's a very important one. I go out and do fundraising and raise money in order so we can offer this to our patients. The second one is the endoscopic resection. That requires specialized equipment, and also not only that, but specialized training. I don't know why the Americans haven't adopted this, but it required me to go to Japan and, interestingly, Colombia in South America, where there's a small Japanese community, speaking Spanish, of course, and in order to learn those techniques and bring them back here.
So then do you see, now that you're having successes in pilot institutions, this will become incorporated into curriculum for training?
I believe so. I'm actually surfing. I just came from our international meeting for thoracic surgery last week to talk about endoscopic resections, and I was approached by probably 15 to 20 people looking to learn these techniques in a English-speaking environment or French-speaking environment, if you will.
There's another question about predispositions. Predispositions for the development of esophageal cancer. A teenager diagnosed with eosinophilic esophagitis. Are these conditions precursors, or can they influence the development of esophageal cancer?
No. First of all, no. But interestingly, eosinophilic esophagitis is a diagnosis we did not even know existed 10 years ago, at least in the adult population. It is now considered to be the number one cause of difficulty swallowing, that dysphagia, the one that prompts an early endoscopy in patients under the age of 40. But it is not related at all to malignancy. It is related a lot to the other sort of atypic symptoms such as asthma and eczema. And we treat it with similar steroids as we do with asthma. So that is completely unrelated. I'm not aware of any association with malignancy. But it can cause some of the similar symptoms. And often we identify diagnosis with an endoscopy and a biopsy. But it has no risk for malignancy.
Susan? What symptoms did you have when you were first diagnosed with colorectal cancer, your first experience?
It was actually an incidental finding. I had bleeding hemorrhoids that brought me to the doctor. The hemorrhoids were tied off, and I was sent home. A month later, I started to bleed again, went for a colonoscopy, and found I had cancer.
The question for any of the three scientists. Could tumor biopsies and markers or DNA mutations be used to stratify those diseases that may progress or not? What's your thoughts on that?
I think that's an excellent point. We are actually working with MORAG looking at exactly that question, whether or not we can determine from the biopsy if we can predict people who are going to have it come back and where it's going to come back. Right now, we can't, at least not for stomach esophagus cancer, but we are actively looking at that. We're probably one of the few centers in the world looking at that exact topic. Can we find out from the biopsy, the moment of diagnosis, when and where that tumor can come back so we can treat it before it happens or be proactive? I wish I could say we have the answers yet, but we're in the process of working with the Goodman Cancer Center in order to look for those answers.
And similar work is being done in colon cancer and in liver cancer and pancreas cancer as well. So, yes, it's a goal, but it's far from being a reality.
Maybe you could comment on some of the current targets or markers that antibodies are being directed to for colorectal cancer. So CCAM1 is a cell surface protein. There's a candidate marker that has biological function, but are some of the other candidates?
Actually, in a different type of cancer, in melanoma, there's a group in Israel that have actually moved to clinical trials as an immunotherapy against CCAM1 with altered T cells being added. All of the results I described tonight were done with only a single procedure. There was no chemotherapy. We don't give chemotherapy to mice yet. Will happen, I'm sure. But essentially, you know, we're going for a one-drug trial. In most patients, it's never just one. There's not one magic bullet. There's essentially a combination of therapies, be it surgery, be it chemotherapy, immunotherapies coming online, genetic therapies are coming online, vaccines are coming online. So it's going to take a little more time.
There was a lot of discussion about colorectal cancer and the spreading to the liver, but you really didn't discuss very much about spreading to the lung.
No.
Can you, please?
Certainly. So the lung is one of the other common sites of metastasis of colon cancer, and as we've all seen tonight, can be treated surgically as well. In fact, though there are limited series published on this, the survivals that we saw for liver resection can be reproduced essentially with lung resection. And in fact, in combination of liver and lung, the survival, if both are resected, is equivalent if you only had the liver disease. So there is a potential for cure there as well. And some of the ablative technologies and radiosurgery are also now being used to deal with smaller lung lesions.
Indeed, I may comment. We often see the same patient. I do lung surgery as well, and we would often see the same patient in that, where we look at targeting the liver, the primary tumor, the liver, and the lung in a sequential manner.
I just want to say I was given 95% chance the first time around, which failed. I was also given 25% chance to live 5 years, 20 years ago when I had the lung removed. So, you know, data is not absolute.
Definitely. Absolutely.
You've mentioned that surgical resection for colorectal cancer metastasis to the liver is a viable treatment curative option. Can you comment on why this hasn't expanded, let's say, other cancers that are metastatic to the liver? In terms of, let's say, breast cancer that's metastatic to liver, when or is surgery indicated in, and what might be some of the considerations about who's a candidate for resection?
I think there are a variety of reasons for that. One is that it's a fairly direct route of metastasis from the colon to the liver, and so usually the people who will do well with that kind of disease really have disease that is limited only to the liver. For breast cancer to have gotten to the liver, it's gone through a lot of other places as well, and likely is in a lot of other places as well, although we can't detect it or see it on the imaging and other techniques that we have. So what has happened, certainly people have tried this, and when one operates indiscriminately on other cancers, one finds that the patients tend to recur very rapidly, if not in the liver, then elsewhere. So I would say that it's a field that's evolving, and in highly selected patients with other malignancies, we will consider resection. But these would have to be patients who are basically single metastasis or very low number metastasis after a long disease-free interval with other very good prognostic features, good responsiveness to chemotherapy, things like this. To think of liver resection as a last-ditch attempt to save really puts it in a bad place, because when it's used in that context, it's often too late.
If an individual had to go in for a gastric cancer and partial or complete removal of the stomach, what are the prognosis, some of the aspects of recovery associated with that type of an intervention?
It primarily depends on the stage of the tumor, the clinical stage of the tumor. The only way we know we can truly staged tumors is actually if we once we've taken it out and look at the lymph nodes. So it all depends on. It's hard to really talk about prognosis until the tumor has been removed. For tumors of the stomach, nowadays probably around 85% of them are done through small incisions laparoscopically. So the recovery is much quicker than beforehand. Usually it would be a 5 to 7 day stay in the hospital. Now with laparoscopic approaches, between three and four days. So the recovery is quite rapid.
Okay. Once tumors have metastasized to the liver, are all liver metastases created equal? Or are there different types of metastases within the liver?
That's an excellent question, and the answer is probably that we don't know, that we're still trying to find this out. Certainly there seem to be both molecular signatures and even histologic features that may distinguish different types of metastases one from the other, but we really are only in the early stages of exploring this. We know that a tumor interacts with its environment and that the normal liver around a tumor interacts with it as well. And we are really only at the very beginnings, I would say, of understanding what those interactions are and how we could understand, target, or use those to predict prognosis and outcome.
Perfect. Well, that's all of the questions. Thank you very, very much for submitting such great questions. I would like also to thank our four speakers for very informative and engaging seminars. So thank you very much. And just before you leave, I would just like to certainly acknowledge the continued support that the Cancer Center receives from the Goodmans, Rosalind and Morris Goodman, and really for Rosalind for being the champion for the need for such events like this public forum, which you all make such a resounding success. Special thanks to Annette and Petal for their efforts in organizing the public forums, and for the volunteers, Stella, Notkin, Dale, and Marla, for their generous donation of their time in volunteering for helping to make this event what it is. And we have one more public forum to close out our session, which will be on May the 27th, and it will be focused on aspects of cancer prevention. So mark that on your calendars, and I hope to see you at the end of May. Thank you very, very much.